America may be the land of free, but patients owe at least $220 billion in medical debt, and experts say healthcare costs have grown faster than inflation. What if there's an overlooked reason why patients in some parts of the U.S. have more debt than others?
There is strong evidence that, you know, areas of the country where you saw an increase in hospital market concentration, you also see people being less likely to be able to pay their medical debt. So with that shows you that, you know, hospital market concentration is related to medical debt.
We're talking with two researchers who say that they've uncovered some answers. Frederick Blavin and Breno Braga are researchers with the think tank Urban Institute.
In this county, our measure of market concentration increased by, you know, over 100%, 113% over this period. And this was largely due to the fact that, you know, two of the four hospitals within this county closed during this period. And if you look closely at the medical debt in this county, medical debt collections increased by close to one percentage point among adults over this time period. And just to give you some perspective, over the same period, the share of adults with medical debt collections nationally declined by 7.7 percentage points between 2012 and 2022.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, let me welcome both of you to Conversations on Healthcare. Fred, let's start with you. What is Urban Institute's changing medical debt landscape tool? And maybe you can tell our listeners, how did you use it to explore the link between hospital market concentrations and people's ability to pay their healthcare bills on time?
Yeah, the changing medical debt landscape is an interactive data tool that shows medical debt in collections reported to credit bureau agencies from 2011 to 2023. It's not all medical debt. It's only debt that goes to collections. The feature shows data at the national level, as well as at the state and county levels. And you can also explore changes in medical debt among communities of color and predominantly white communities as well. The feature also includes data on other factors related to medical debt, such as changes in health insurance coverage or health insurance coverage over time, hospital mergers and closures that occurred within specific marketplaces, the prevalence of disability, as well as hospital market concentration. And that's where we kind of took our latest analysis, because we saw, you know, some different patterns in market changes and market concentration were potentially related to medical debt as well, which kind of motivated us for our analysis that looked at the link between medical debt and market concentration.
Well, Breno, there's a lot there for us to understand. I'm so glad we have you to help us tease this out. I think you've noted that in 2017, 90% of hospital markets in the U.S. were highly concentrated. Seems kind of challenging that you could go higher than 90% on anything in this country. But since then, hospital market concentration, I understand, has only grown. Can you tell us, what does this mean? It seems like it should be obvious, but it's not obvious to me. How you define market concentration when it comes to hospitals?
Sure. In economics, market concentration measures how competitive a market is. So that is whether a small number of firms dominate the market. So typically, markets with a high concentration, they have undesirable consequences for consumers, such as higher prices. In particular, in our study, we use something called the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, the HHI, which measures the number of hospitals and the size of those hospitals in a particular hospital market area. So let's say if you are in an area like, you know, Montgomery County, Maryland, and you have just one or two hospitals there, and they serve most of the population, that's considered an area that is highly concentrated in terms of their market, which probably has undesirable consequences for the consumers.
Fred, we're a big country, and I'm wondering, is $220 billion a lot? Seems like a lot. What's the sort of run rate been on medical debt over the last decade? And I think people would be interested in having some larger perspective on this.
Right. So, you know, in the data tool, we show that, you know, in 2013, for example, 19.5% of consumers in the U.S. had some form of medical debt in collections. Now, this declined quite a bit over time. By 2023, 5% had medical debt in collections, but this is largely due to some voluntary changes from the credit bureaus in 2022 and 2023, where they, for example, removed medical collections under $500 from consumer credit reports. And so that's not the underlying debt that consumers have. That's just the amount that they have in collections. More recent survey data indicates that roughly 4 out of 10 adults in the United States have any medical or dental bill past due. That gives you a sense really of what the scope is in terms of how many consumers have medical debt within the country.
Well, Brenna, the American Hospital Association says that medical debt is tied to inadequate healthcare coverage and high deductible health plans that intentionally push more costs onto patients, and certainly high deductible health plans are very, very attractive in many organizations. But it says most hospitals provide free care for patients with the most limited means, defined as income below 200% of the federal poverty level. And what's your response to that?
Well, it's an interesting statement. I'll say the first part of the statement is backed by research. So there is strong evidence that being uninsured is a stronger predictor of having medical debt. So if you just look at the map of the country, and you're going to see that the areas where there is the highest share of the population with medical debt, those are the areas where people are less likely to have health insurance as well. There is also a couple of studies out there showing the causal evidence that states that expanded Medicaid, if you look at those states, you know, 1 or 2 years after the expansion, you see a reduction in medical debt in those states. So definitely, you know, having health insurance is important. Mm-hmm. Even though it's important, might be not enough, you know. So there's also data from the census showing that among all the households in the country where everybody in the household has health insurance, so everybody's covered by health insurance, 16% of those households have medical debt. So meaning, you know, especially for this middle and low income households, you know, having health insurance might not be enough. And the reason is, as you probably know, you know, the increasing in deductibles, co-payment, co-insurance are making harder and harder for even folks with health insurance to pay their medical bills. So the first part of the statement, I think it's backed by research. The second part of the statement, I don't know if it is. So it's actually, there is some study out there showing that if you look at all the nonprofit hospitals in the country, for 86% of those nonprofit hospitals, the amount of benefit they receive in terms of tax exemption is greater than the amount of charity care they provide. So if you're a nonprofit hospital, you don't have to pay as much taxes as a for-profit hospital or as like a for-profit firm. So you get those benefits of paying less tax. So for 86% of these nonprofit hospitals, the amount of benefit they receive is not enough compared to the amount of charity care that they provide. So we think that hospitals could be doing, especially the nonprofit hospitals, could be doing a little bit more to address this issue.
You know, Fred, you propose a number of policy solutions, and you want to implement more stringent requirements on nonprofit hospitals, and you want the IRS to specify a stricter dollar amount for charity care and community benefits. I take it these are administrative actions that really require an administration to embrace them, or am I wrong on that? What's the sort of likelihood of getting those through, or are there other strategies to implement them, and maybe walk through what your proposals would do at the same time?
Yeah, so I'm clear that, you know, we're not advocating for one policy or another necessarily. We're just kind of mentioning some potential policies that could address the medical debt problem. On the stricter enforcement of charity care community benefits, as Brenda mentioned, you know, federal law requires that nonprofit hospitals provide some level of charity care for a condition of receiving their tax-exempt status. There's also federal law related to community benefits, and more generally in terms of hospitals having to establish financial assistance policies and determine if patients qualify for charity care before engaging in extraordinary collection actions. But you know, these laws are generally poorly enforced. Their effects on charity care spending and extraordinary collection actions are limited based on what we can tell from the most recent research in this area. And they also don't extend to for-profit hospitals and non-hospital providers. In terms of thinking about this, you know, with the new with you know, Republicans controlling the House and Senate and the presidency, you know, it seems unlikely that there's going to be stricter regulation within this area. I think if anything, you're seeing a lot of proposals on the right, you know, coming out of the Trump campaign and coming out of the Republican National Committee related to, if anything, stripping back, say, Medicaid benefits in terms of potentially making cuts to the federal matching rate for the Medicaid expansion population, or making other cuts to what's called, you know, the FMAP percentage in terms of what the federal government pays for Medicaid. And I think this could have, you know, potential adverse consequences for consumers, especially low-income patients who rely on Medicaid. You know, seven states actually have trigger laws where if there are any potential cuts to the federal match on the expansion population, they can get out of their Medicaid expansion. And so there are potential other kind of changes that we can expect politically that could have adverse effects for consumers and medical debt.
Well, that is certainly something I'll add to my list of things that we can worry about over these coming coming weeks and months. But I also, you know, want to ask this question, Breno, maybe. I think you've noted you want better enforcement of antitrust laws to promote a more competitive healthcare marketplace. And I'm wondering how realistic is this today? Mm-hmm. The Federal Trade Commission's been fairly weak historically in this regard. And of course, how realistic is it, do you think, going forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think our goal here and what we do is to try to show the facts to people and, you know, policymakers, and they can make the best decisions they can. So there is strong evidence that, you know, areas of the country where you saw an increase in hospital market concentration, you also see people being less likely to be able to pay the medical debt. So with that shows you that, you know, hospital market concentration is related to medical debt. And if, you know, the goal of, you know, policymakers is to help those folks to pay those bills, we have to think more about, you know, making those market more competitive. So one thing we always like to mention is now only big mergers and acquisitions need to be revealed by the Federal Trade Commission and the DOJ. So if you live in an area, there's like just two small hospitals that are merging, like those mergers, they don't have to be reviewed in advance. So this is something that you can decrease the threshold for the size of the mergers and acquisitions that need to be reviewed by the Federal Trade Commission or the DOJ. The other thing that I think it relates to what we've been discussing now is that nonprofit hospitals are not subject to review by the Federal Trade Commissions because they are nonprofit hospitals. But as Fred and I mentioned before, a lot of these nonprofit hospitals are behaving exactly like for-profit hospitals. So they might have anti-competitive behaviors as the nonprofit hospital. So maybe the Federal Trade Commission should also, you know, we should think about ways for the Federal Trade Commission to also review the behavior of those hospitals.
You know, maybe to both of you, we're seeing certainly the Federal Trade Commission recently held a hearing on private equity in hospitals. And I'm wondering how those, one, how are those reviewed? Are they under the regulatory framework of the FTC? And what have been the implications? I don't know if you've teased out in your study of those hospitals that are for-profit and have private equity, or what can you tell our listeners about the impact that private equity is having, and maybe it's how it rolls up in terms of total medical debt as well?
So, you know, unfortunately, we can't tease that out within our data in terms of private equity ownership within the hospitals that we have in our study. You know, I think that is an area that is ripe for research in terms of what are the implications of private equity in terms of medical debt, in terms of whether or not providers that are acquired through private equity are more aggressive in pursuing medical debt from patients upon acquisition or not. But that's something that we can't really dive into within our data.
You're doing a great job of making some formerly obtuse things clear. So we're just going to keep going with this. And Fred, I think you're calling for reducing incentives for consolidation. One way to approach the problem by changing the Medicare payment schedule. And you've pointed out that there's differences in the schedule when we compare hospital outpatient departments, for instance, to a physician's office. And yep, that seems obvious, but unpack for us what's going on here, what's the consequences, and why would this reduce the incentive for consolidation?
Right. So this kind of gets to the issue of site-neutral payment reform. So as you mentioned, you know, Medicare pays for services provided in hospital outpatient departments at higher rates than in ambulatory surgical centers or within a physician offices. So MedPAC and others have done a lot of research indicating that if you look at services that are similar that can be conducted, you know, quite easily across all these three settings, that there's really no difference in the quality of care provided within one setting versus another, and that there are significantly higher payments within these hospital outpatient departments. And so this is one potential driver in of itself of higher costs within the healthcare system, within the Medicare program. So proponents of site-based payment reform argue that these, you know, payments based on site of service have led to an increase in the number of services provided in these higher cost, you know, hospital outpatient departments, and also encourage further consolidation where hospitals have an incentive to consolidate and purchase or acquire hospital or physician practices. And since they're able to get higher reimbursement rates for services provided within those hospital outpatient mm-hmm. departments, this kind of further drives up kind of healthcare spending within the Medicare program. And there's really no evidence out there indicating that this has a quality improving effect among patients.
Reno, let's pull the thread a little on what Fred just said there, because you want to prevent hospital closures to avoid higher market concentrations. And I'm wondering what the strategy is here. Are you sort of proposing a provider relief fund similar to we had during Medicaid or during COVID? What's your thinking here?
Yeah, so when people think about market concentration, they often think about mergers and acquisitions. But yep. another way that the market gets more concentrated is when a hospital closes, right? So think about this. If you have like four hospitals in your market area and then one of them closes, the other three hospitals.
Is that a big thing that's happening around the country? That hospital, are these more rural hospitals or these rural. Urban? Yeah.
It's actually both. There is the impression that most of the hospital closures are rural, but that's not true. Like, there is a lot of hospital closures in urban areas as well. But we have strong evidence showing that areas where experience a hospital closure, you see an increase in medical debt, you know, a couple of years later. And then one way that happens is through market concentration. So people have less options to go, and the remaining hospitals can charge higher prices from patients. We also can think that hospitals that remain, they can be more aggressive in terms of collecting the debt too, because there is less competition. But also one thing that people usually don't think about is if you have less options near you, you might wait longer to seek treatment for like a cancer or something else. And if this treatment is more complex, probably the bill that you're going to have, it's going to be more expensive as well. So just the fact that you have less options near you might mean that like you're going to have a worse health outcome. And then as a result of that, you're going to have more medical bills to pay.
And adding one thing to that, you know, there's an example in our changing medical debt landscape tool of, you know, specific county. So if you look at Delaware County within the tool, this was a county that experienced some of the greatest increases in hospital market concentration between 2012 and 2022. In this county, you know, our measure of market concentration increased by, you know, over 100%, 113% over this period. And this was largely due to the fact that, you know, two of the four hospitals within this county closed during this period. And if you look closely at the medical debt in this county, medical debt collections increased by close to one percentage point among adults over this time period. And just to give you some perspective, over the same period, the share of adults with medical debt collections nationally declined by 7.7 percentage points between 2012 and 2022. So this kind of gives a bit of an example of how you can see how a hospital closure could affect market concentration mm-hmm. within a county and could ultimately have some sort of effect on medical debt collections.
Well, I wonder, and either of you could answer this, but it really comes from your prior comments. Certainly the impact on consolidation and on debt is clear, but we're also looking at some very real outcomes on people's lives. And particularly, I think what we're seeing in many states is a reduction in access to maternity care right at the same time that mortality and morbidity rates in pregnancy are going up. And as hospitals consolidate, and particularly in rural areas, I don't know as much if this is happening in the urban areas, closing the maternity obstetrical service seems to be a first action. States are responding with things like mobile health units, community health centers are responding. But what's the level of oversight that's going on related to these consolidations about essential services like maternity? Do you all look at that as part of your calculus about the economic impact?
You're not in this study, but this is something that we've worked on. I've worked on with other researchers as well in terms of, responses to a hospital closure, specifically the example of a closure of a maternity care ward. And so, this is a huge issue, especially in rural areas where there's, more distance between consumers and their healthcare providers. So when you have a closure of a maternity care ward, that could significantly increase the driving distance to right. your nearest hospital. And so this is a very large concern in terms of access to care and potential health outcomes. There's already a lot of research out there indicating that when a hospital closes, particularly in rural areas, that increase in distance and driving time to the nearest emergency room and hospital really has effects on patients' health and risk of mortality as well. So this is something that is something to carefully look out for, and is a concern, particularly for rural markets across the U.S.
Let me just sort of expand a little from that one niche of maternity and sort of ask, or maybe get on your wish list for things we'd like you to study, the impact on primary care. So when hospitals are buying primary care practices and making them part of the hospital, it drives more of the encounters to be billed by the hospital versus the freestanding primary care provider. And we are advocates for expanding primary care, very worried about these private equity, hospital-owned health systems coming up, and it's squeezing out primary care. So how did you tease out the impact, or were you able to look at where there's a robust primary healthcare system and less reliance on the ED or the hospital-based or controlled primary care providers and those who are independent? Any light that you could shed on that, or is that for the next study coming up?
For this study, this is something that we didn't get into in the study. I think the study that we're primarily discussing today is kind of looking at that link between market concentration and medical debt collections. And that is, within our medical debt data, we just know it's medical debt. We don't know the source of the medical debt in terms of the specific provider or provider type. We're looking at hospital data where we're, in terms of coming up with our measure of market concentration, that is just based on adjusted admissions within a health system within a given market. So that's not something we've teased out with this study, but it is definitely something that is ripe for future research.
We look forward to that. And I'd like to ask you to maybe share with our listeners some perhaps vivid examples of how this plays out in communities. Fred, you note that about 27 million consumers had debt and collections on their credit card reports in 2022. But disproportionately, communities of color and people living in the South in the United States were disproportionately affected. Can you give us an example of where this is playing out in one community as a kind of an exemplar?
Yeah, I mentioned the one example in Delaware County. I think that is a good example, specific to medical debt collections. But, you are right in that, most of medical communities with high medical debt are concentrated in the South, and they're concentrating in states that have not expanded Medicaid so far. And so, you know, in another study that we looked at, you know, we looked at what county characteristics are associated with higher levels of medical debt. So, you know, Medicaid expansion is a big piece, geographic location as well, which is, you know, highly related to Medicaid expansion decisions, and also kind of the health of communities. So we found that counties that have a significantly worse health status based on average number of chronic conditions and prevalence of disability within the communities, that is the largest factor in determining whether or not determining high medical debt within that community. And so, you know, the underlying health of a community, sometimes we don't necessarily think about this, but ultimately, the worse health that you're in, the more likely you are to encounter the healthcare system, the more likely you are to accrue medical debt over time. So that is one of the largest predictors of medical debt within our country. In our medical debt tool, you can see that states that had the largest decline in medical debt following the voluntary changes by the credit bureau agencies to remove medical debt under $500 from the credit reports, those were concentrated in the South as well. So I think the top five states that were most affected by this policy were West Virginia, South Carolina, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Right now, the states that have the lowest levels of medical debt collections are Colorado, but they have instituted a state policy that removed all medical debt collections for consumers within that state. As well as Minnesota, Hawaii, Vermont, and Washington all have very low levels of medical debt, under about 2% of consumers within the state.
Very, very, very intentional and a result of progressive legislative changes. Yeah. Thank you for calling those out.
Maybe you could just take a minute to talk a little bit about either one of you, the Urban Institute, founded in 1968 by President Lyndon Johnson. Tell our listeners a little more about the size and the scope and the focus of the Institute.
The Urban Institute has, I believe over around 500, maybe more than 500 employees. And we have research covering various social and economic policy areas. So, you know, I'm a principal researcher in the Health Policy Center. Breno's a researcher in labor and human policy. We also have a joint tax policy center with the Brookings Institution, an education policy center, a metro policy center, which focuses a lot on housing related issues within the U.S. And so, you know, we are a fairly large organization with a lot of capabilities in analyzing the effects of policies, forecasting the effects of various policies as well. And so, you know, we have a lot of capabilities in terms of, you know, what would be the likely effects of, in the healthcare space specifically. Like, we've done a lot of work on forecasting what would be the effects of repealing the Affordable Care Act on healthcare costs and healthcare coverage within the U.S. And done a lot of work on, you know, pre-ACA implementation on, you know, writing about the anticipated effects of those policies as well. Breno, anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I just want to add, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. So our goal is to provide the public with, you know, the best statistics, the best facts, and help people to make the best decisions for themselves, and also policymakers and other stakeholders to make best decisions.
Well, thank you for joining us, Frederick Blavin and Breno Braga from the Urban Institute. And thanks to our audience for being here. Just a reminder to be sure and subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name, CHC Radio. And as always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for our email updates. And please, you can also share your thoughts and your comments about this program with us. Take care. Be well. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.